Welcome to Animal Voices. This weekly program is presented through the cooperation of three local groups, Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection, Earth Save Canada, and the Vancouver Humane Society. My name is Marge Adams, and in the studio with me, our co-host, Carl Loskin, and our announcer and technician, Alan Jensen. Now, on today's show, we will feature two guests, Sarah Dubois of the British Columbia Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, who will be telling us about the symposium held in Vancouver last week, where the issue of exotic animals in captivity was the focus. In the second half hour, we'll hear from Deborah Probert of the Vancouver Humane Society, who will inform us about recent success in the long-term campaign by animal activists against formerly known as Kentucky Fried Chicken. There has been progress made in that on that campaign that we're very, very pleased with. Now, we have our first guest, I think, on the line right now, so that I will tell you a little bit more about Sarah Dubois. She is the manager of Wildlife Services for the British Columbia SPCA, she was also an organizer for the recent symposium. Welcome to Animal Voices, Sarah. Are you there?
I am. Thank you for inviting me.
Wonderful to have you on the line. Now, Sarah, I know that you were a key part of this whole symposium, and I would like you to tell us what it was all about. Can you give us an outline maybe of the people who were involved or the groups who were involved, and we can go from there?
Sounds good. Yeah, the symposium was an undertaking of the BCSPCA thanks to the support in part by the Vancouver Foundation, who funded part of the symposium. And it was really a forum to bring together government agencies like the Ministry of Environment, the Conservation Officer Service. We also had a Crown Counsel there and a coroner. We also brought in agents who work in bylaw services from the municipalities of, for example, Prince George, Kamloops, Maple Ridge, Delta, Vancouver, Burnaby, all these agents who have to deal with exotic animal issues in their communities came together. Of course, there were BCSPCA staff and especially our constables who have to, again, deal with the cruelty issues of the possession of exotic animals. And then there were several veterinarians that were there that have worked and have clients with exotic animals. And also we had some individuals who represented the zoo community, so the accredited and facilities that have legitimate, accreditation procedures that they go through to become zoos, to really give a perspective of what we're talking about when we look at exotic animals as pets. And we did have a representative from the pet industry as well.
Goodness sakes, you certainly had a wide representation. That's wonderful. I'm sure it was very profitable to getting all those points of view together. Now, there must have been something that spearheaded the decision to have such a conference at this time. Can you tell us what that was?
Absolutely. It was actually something we knew about. We applied for funding about a year ago. And we thought if the legislation that the Ministry of Environment, they actually were considering, they put out a call to the public last April in 2007 and said, we need to update the Wildlife Act. Will you please submit? So groups, everyone from hunting organizations to wildlife rehabilitators, to anyone who has wildlife in captivity and organizations like ourselves who are trying to protect wildlife, they wrote in their ideas for the changes that should be made to an act that was really designed to accommodate fishing and hunting regulations.
I see.
And so we knew that there was going to be some changes afoot, and especially with the real tragedy of, Tanya Nefrisous, who was tragically killed in an accident with her fiancé's pet tiger. So that really spearheaded, I think that really made the government aware that there is a huge gap when it comes to regulating wild animals. Because
yes.
Wild animals currently in the province of British Columbia, before this legislation was proposed, actually were only the animals that grew up here, you can say, like the animals that you see, like raccoons and deer and the squirrels and all those animals that are indigenous to British Columbia. But when you talk about a lion or a tiger or a crocodile or primates, those animals come in from other countries. At some point, they're bred in captivity for the most part now, and so there was no real regulation. No one, no federal government, no provincial government, no municipal government had the ability to seize the tiger in question was part of the tragedy. So everyone was looking for solutions. So the RCMP was also involved in our symposium, and we all wanted to just discuss if this were, you know, what could we do to resolve so that something like this would never happen again. You know, we have to have somebody who has the legal ability to seize these animals when they pose a public safety issue.
It's amazing when you think about it. All these years, no legislation at all covering the exotic animals at any level.
Absolutely. And you could have a pet, you know, tiger in your small apartment living in your closet, but you can't have a pet raccoon or a pet squirrel because they're native animals to mm-hmm. British Columbia. So it does seem quite odd, and that there was a huge gap that we didn't recognize. And because a lot of the people who own these animals live in remote communities because of the size of properties they have and that type of thing, we don't always know that these animals are in our community until there is a big problem.
There must have been some very disparate views coming from, for example, zookeepers and the SPCA. Did you get a lot of argument going on?
Well, you know, we had some great discussion, and that was, you know, what I really need to emphasize is what we learned from actually all being in the same room together is that, in general, we agree upon 90% of things, mm-hmm. and there's 10% that we disagree upon. And we always are focusing, unfortunately, and sometimes in these animal movements, on only that 10%. We all want the best care, humane care for these animals. But there's the way we do it, or et cetera. You know, it's that 10% that we disagree on that we're constantly fighting over, and our energies are towards. So mm-hmm. one of the speakers actually talked about how, you know, we need to focus on that 90% we do agree on and move forward and ensure that people who do have these really poor roadside zoos actually take responsibility and either meet the standard of a accredited zoo to possess these animals in captivity, or somehow we need to get those animals out of there.
There must have been particular aims of your organization, I would think.
We really wanted to bring all these stakeholders together. That was our aim. You know, this hasn't happened before where we've had the opportunity to sit down, discuss these issues in a very professional manner, you know, and realistically say, we know there's a problem. How are we all going to work towards resolving it? Because we all are brought into the situation when there is a tiger attack, and everyone just kind of points fingers and said, well, is it your responsibility to do this part, or ours responsibility covers this legislation? And so there just needs to be some really uniform approach to addressing the issue of exotic animals. And we're not talking about, you know, a broad stroke of, you know, people's pet canaries and things like that. You know, there was a lot of concern beforehand that the BCSPCA was trying to ban all non-domestic pets, and that's not true. We understand that people get great enjoyment out of having pet canaries and things like that, and when these animals are bred in captivity, you know, they can have good welfare in homes. So
what was the outcome of all this discussion? It went on for a couple of days, didn't
it? No, it was just a one-day symposium.
Oh, yeah.
But it just happened to be on the same day that the legislature, the last sitting of the legislature, and the legislation passed that day, the Bill 29, which gave enabling powers to the Minister of Environment to create regulations, happened the same day. So it was very ironic because we picked this day, you know, months and months ahead of when we knew the legislature was ending. So
that's very interesting.
It's all about timing.
Yes. Now, yeah. Enabling legislation, that gives power to the minister?
Yes. Yeah, so now what happens is that now the minister's staff and the Minister of Environment go back and create regulations. And that's going to be a process that maybe takes 8 months to a year. And that's going to actually list which species may be prohibited in owning British Columbia, which species may be regulated, and others that might be monitored. So we hope, and what comes out of the actual symposium, is that now we know who has to be at that table to create those regulations and who should be having input, because it isn't something that the Ministry of Environment is going to do without listening to the vet community and the humane organizations and, you know, the zoo community and that type of thing, because we all have a role to play.
And now, so that you'll have input into who are the individuals that sit to try and draw up legislation?
We hope that we're going to be one of those individuals and that other parties that were there that day will also be able to participate, because it is a big process that we have to go through. You know, it's very difficult to just say, well, why this animal and not this animal, and you know, some people might be able to provide care for this animal in captivity and others not. You know, we have to really look at what in terms of public safety is going to be an issue, in terms of disease is going to be an issue, and those types of things.
There are a lot of considerations. I wonder if the public will have a chance to feed in at meetings or hearings.
Well, the public already did have a chance through the process where last year, but hopefully, you know, I know that the ministry staff is accepting, you know, emails and input as well. So that's something that, you know, is still ongoing.
Now, so that this is something we can anticipate happening, and I suppose that a lot of us are concerned about the broader issue of these exotic animals with being captured in the wild and desecrating species and so forth. So there's going to be a wide-ranging consideration, isn't there, to be acted upon?
Absolutely, and you know, some of the things do, yes, affect animals in the wild, and others. A lot of these animals are bred in captivity, and it's even, you know, more difficult to know where these breeders are. And you know, at least when the animals are coming into the country, there are some, you know, legal checks and balances that we know they're coming in. But some can come in illegally, of course. But it's the breeding in the country. There's more lions and tigers in captivity than, you know, they think that there are left in the wild. So it's pretty scary that we're you know, allowing this to happen, and these animals are not pure, you know, they're often different subspecies of tiger being bred, you know, Siberian and Sumatran and different things. So these animals would never be releasable back to the wild, so there's no conservation value to having these animals, which is an argument often of the owners, that they're saving the species, but it's really not true. It's just for personal gain.
Sure. Now, Alan has a question for you.
You bet.
Hi. I was wondering what other jurisdictions, other provinces, or other countries in Europe or wherever have done. It's great that the provincial government here is finally moving in the direction of creating some legislation to protect exotic animals. But are there other provinces that have, or other jurisdictions that have put together programs or policies that we can learn from?
Absolutely. Apparently, I've seen the Alberta regulations, and they're quite good. It's about enforcement as well, and apparently Manitoba's regulations for exotic animals are significant. So you have to combine the legislation and the regulations with adequate enforcement, because the law and the rules mean nothing if you can't enforce them. There are definitely a lot of strong protection governances in countries in Europe, but in terms of Canada and the U.S., unfortunately, you know, it's really a patchwork of, you know, some states have it, some municipalities have it, some counties have it. You know, there's, you know, we just had Tippi Hedren in town, and she told us all about how canned hunts are prevalent in the state of Texas, for example, where, you know, lions and tigers and other big animals are no longer of use in roadside attractions, and they're actually shot by hunters for, you know, tens of thousands of dollars.
I think that happens in Alberta too, if I'm not mistaken.
That I don't know about.
I believe it does, but also the city of Vancouver, if I'm not mistaken, the city of Vancouver last year, or maybe it was even earlier this year, passed some legislation protecting exotic animals. Isn't that correct?
Yes. So municipalities to date have had the power to create municipal bylaws to say they don't want these animals in their community. So that's been helpful, but the problem is that most municipalities don't have an enforcement structure that could really do that. So the smaller municipalities have not gone ahead with that legislation or those bylaws in their communities. And what's happened was, you know, in the tiger incident in 100 Mile House, is that tiger lived in the Lower Mainland until the municipality changed its bylaw. And then that tiger moved up north. So the problem is that people can acquire these animals and move all around if we don't have consistent legislation.
I guess ideally it would be a federal law that would cover it, wouldn't it? That all of Canada have uniformity.
Well, it would be great to have some federal legislation, especially when it comes to the protection of wild birds. Unfortunately, in Canada, we still allow wild birds to be imported for the pet trade. Even in the U.S., it's been banned. Now, there's a lot of birds that are bred in captivity, so I don't think that we need to bring, and, you know, we all know about the horrible transport death rates and these animals that are killed and die during capture and transport, so that's not something that we can support, of course. So the federal legislation for that would be great. I think provincial legislation right now is going to be great for British Columbia, and hopefully other provinces will model, because we hope that we're going to be, you know, one of the strongest advocates for wild animals in BC.
I believe the provincial government cut back on the budget for the conservation officers a couple of years ago.
They sure did. Some time ago, they did lay off conservation officer staff. But I'm hoping, you know, that they will help the conservation officers, you know, gain further resources, because they can't do it alone. We can't do it alone with our officers in remote communities. RCMP are dealing with the issue. So it is has to be a joint issue, but we also need a lot of training. A lot of our people, a lot of the RCMP, a lot of the conservation officer service have never dealt with these types of large carnivores and primates and these things. And if they ever had to go into a place, you know, they need to know the proper precautions that they have to take. So it's very important, training and resource implementation in addition to this.
And informing the public about the...
Yes. So once the regulations are in place, I hope that they will launch a public education campaign and let people know that they can register their animals or what conditions under which they can continue to keep their animals, or if they may need to look to find another home outside of British Columbia for those animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how long did you say before the enforcement or enactment, and not enforcement, enactment will be possible?
We're hoping that it's going to be within 8 months to a year. So unfortunately, we can't do anything yet with this legislation until those regulations are in place. We can't use this legislation tool yet. So, yes, there are individuals who can still acquire these animals, sadly, until these regulations are in place. But once they are, then, you know, we hope that we will try to... We have no idea how many of these animals are in our province. This is the problem. We don't know where these animals are. We don't know how many tigers, lions, primates, you know, crocodiles we have in British Columbia. And some people will, you know, especially smaller animals, will release them into the wild if they just can't take care of them anymore. So...
Yeah.
You know, we don't want, you know, people to do that and think that the ministry is going to take their animals. You know, we recognize that some of these animals are going to have to live out their lives in BC, but be sterilized so that they can't breed, and there's conditions around actually their living, you know, situation.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that this comes under the Department of the Environment.
Mm-hmm.
I would have thought that animals would, both wild and exotics, should be under a special department, but I guess not.
It is a branch. It's called the Fish and Wildlife Branch within the Ministry of Environment, and again,
okay.
It's typically been set up to accommodate hunting and fishing regulations, but more and more they're realizing that most British Columbians aren't hunting and fishing anymore, that a lot of the issues are more urban wildlife issues, so they're moving in that direction and is trying to increase staffing in those areas.
I see. Now, Carl has a question for you, Sarah.
Yeah.
Sarah, you're dealing mostly with exotics here, which is, of course, you know, pet stores get involved with that, and, you know, every time I go into a major pet store and I see the animals there, I sort of shudder and say, well, you know, people are buying them, so if they become educated like you're doing, teaching the public about keeping exotics and that they don't really belong in people's homes, that it's a totally unnatural situation. But, you know, Sarah, I got a note from Nature Canada, and they said that many of Canada's animals and plants are threatened by extinction. And they mentioned a figure that there are some 565 endangered species at risk in Canada alone, which is an absolute staggering a number when you consider that this comes from a very reputable source, endangered wildlife in Canada. So maybe some of our own indigenous Canadian animals should be classified in the same vein as exotics because there's so few of them.
Well, with this legislation, it's really about public safety and protection. So there definitely needs to be some work when it comes to endangered species at risk. And it's unfortunate that that element didn't get into the amendments of Bill 29, and we would definitely support, you know, for further protection for endangered species in British Columbia. However, this issue for us is you know, we investigate cruelty of these animals, and the biggest problem is that we don't know where to put them. When we go to a property and we seize primates or we seize big cats, and we have physically nowhere to keep them until the court process goes through and whether or not this person gets to keep their animals. So our legislation really limits us in terms of and just the resources, and you know, there's no sanctuaries for these types of animals in BC. So we're, you know, this is our current issue. There's lots of issues to take on, of course.
Yeah, I'm sure there are.
Yeah, but this one is, you know, we're just absolutely thrilled that within the year that we started work on and advocating for exotic animals, and that this legislation did pass, and that all the players were at the table on the 29th just talking openly about how we move forward. And
that's
exciting to us.
Certainly a good start.
Absolutely.
Now, do you have a website where people might learn more about this?
What they can see on the BCSPCA's website, you can go to sbca.bc.ca/wildlifeact, and that describes our actual submission to the Ministry of Environment that we made. But there is a press release, I'm sure, on the Ministry of Environment's website about the legislation passing. So if you go to the Ministry of Environment and search for Bill 29, I'm sure that that'll be out there.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Sarah, for being with us today. You certainly helped us understand this issue in BC. Some things are a bit shocking to learn.
It's actually reassuring to know that our government does listen to us.
Indeed,
you know,
it is. Very reassuring.
We made the submission last summer, and we've had great response from them. So we're looking forward to working with them in the future.
That's great to hear. Thank you so much for being on Animal Voices.
Take care.
Bye-bye. You have been listening to an interview with Sarah Dubois, the Manager of Wildlife Services for the British Columbia Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And this is CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial, the only independent commercial-free radio in Vancouver. Now, perhaps we could hear it. Would you like to play a bit of music, Alan, or maybe...
From June 20th to the 29th, the 23rd annual Vancouver International Jazz Festival electrifies the city with great sounds from around the world. For 10 music-filled days, over 1,800 artists take to the streets, major theaters, outdoor stages, and nightclubs of Vancouver. Over 40 venues in all. From the free street party on Water Street in Gastown to the Center for Performing Arts. From hip bistros like the Ironworks to great concert halls like the Orpheum Theater and the Commodore. Jazz of all styles and stripes. Blues, funk, soul, Latin, fusion, electronica, and world beat will resonate throughout the city. Herbie Hancock, Wynton Marsalis, John Schofield, Pink Martini, Barry Guy New Orchestra, Divine Brown, Maceo Parker, Charlie Hayden's Quartet West, and Beattie Bell are just a few of the many great artists appearing. The Vancouver International Jazz Festival, June 20th to the 29th. For tickets and information, call the Jazz Hotline at 604-872-5200 or visit coastaljazz.ca.
Thank you for that, Alan. And now we want to talk about a piece of good news, and I think Alan is prepared to tell us about what happened to one whale.
Oh, yeah. We were talking before the show. Carl had a newspaper announcement. You have it there, I think.
Yes, I do.
About this whale, humpback whale, off, was it off Tofino, wasn't it?
In yes, Vancouver, it was in Clackwood Sound, yeah.
Clackwood Sound, that got tied up in a couple of ropes that are hold crab traps in the water. If I'm not mistaken, they were crab traps, right?
Mm-hmm.
And two of these cables that are attached to the crab traps got wrapped around this whale, and it was in dire straits. And it was actually quite a nice story in that some local people, it's a very dangerous operation to go and get close enough to this whale, and you know, so you can cut the cables off this whale. It's not something you can do from a distance. And it was a very risky thing that these chaps did because... there was no other whale. They realized the whale could not survive. They could see the way that these ropes were wrapped around it. It was wrapped around some of its fins and so on. So it was seriously tied up. And there was no way it could escape this, just swimming around and trying to get rid of it itself. So they sort of had to get a little boat and get close enough to the whale so they could cut it off, cut the ropes off the whale. And after they did, they were able to see the whale, swim away and... clearly, it had survived its ordeal.
Now, apparently, it took 2.5 hours for them to cut away the crab trap ropes and to free the whale. So it was a baby whale. And, humpback whales are relatively solitary animals, and they just join in the groups mainly for feeding and breeding. And they travel, they're called Pacific Ocean humpbacks. And their migratory path is all the way from the Hawaiian Islands, some 4,200 kilometers away, all the way up to Alaska, where they feed in the summer. So this is wonderful feel-good story about this person, Mr. Ford, who had taken part in 10 similar events. So it shows you what a hazard these crab traps are in these waterways.
Yeah, it's like the fishing nets, too. A lot of the fishing, especially the ones out at that are used at deep sea, these long, long nets that stretch out for miles. And all sorts of dolphins and whales and seabirds get trapped in these things. They're really death traps for the wild animals out there. And the fishermen really don't do very much to try and protect the animals there, and especially when they're more than 200 miles out at sea, which many of these boats are with the long nets. Of course, the crab traps are close to shore, and that's a different story. And that's a problem for the sea mammals that do come close to shore. It is part of a huge international problem, the wildlife being affected by fishing techniques of one sort or another. And in the southern hemisphere, it's long-line fishing for tuna and so on that ends up catching a lot of birds. The world's albatrosses are disappearing because so many of them end up getting caught in these long lines that are used for tuna in the southern hemisphere. It's it's a type of thing we need to keep abreast of. And if you're buying products, you should be aware that certain types of products you are buying are going to be supporting this industry. If you're buying tuna, you want to be aware of the type of tuna you're buying and where it's from, and if it is part of an industry that is affecting these animals.
Yeah. Now that's a wonderful feel-good story, and of course, as we know that whale meat is being exported to Japan, and recently the United States urged Iceland and Norway to cease exporting whale meat to Japan, and the Iceland had sent 80 tons of whale fin meat, only the whale fin, caught in 2006 season, while Norway had exported 5 tons of minke whale meat to Japan. The two Nordic nations do not recognize a ban on the trade by the United Nations Convention on International Trade and Endangered Species. So this is keeping on going on, and meantime, of course, the the whaling ship Farley Moat is being held up in the harbor by Canadian authorities, and they should be out there, as they always do, protecting the whales and protecting the whales from being harvested as a resource in the Antarctic and the Arctic.
Harvested, that's quite a word, isn't it? It's kind of dumbing down of the word.
Murdering, slaughtered.
Slaughtering, yeah.
The killing, bloodshed is unbelievable.
Dreadful. Now we have our second guest on the line, Deborah Probert, who is the executive director of the Vancouver Humane Society. Deborah is going to be telling us some good news about the KFC campaign, and that's the Kentucky Fried Chicken campaign that's been going on for a long time. Hello, Deborah. Are you there?
Yes. Hi, Marge. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thank you. Now, tell us the good news, Deborah, will you?
It's so nice to be able to give good news for a change about animals. There's been lots of good news this month. KFC Canada has caved in to PETA's request to improve their animal welfare standards for the chickens that they slaughter. So this means that slaughter and also to some extent on-farm conditions for the chickens that are slaughtered for KFC are going to improve drastically, which means a huge, huge change in the amount of suffering that these animals are going to be enduring.
Have the changes been outlined in detail?
Yes. According to PETA, now this was a PETA victory. PETA worked very hard on this campaign, although they had a lot of help, particularly from grassroots organizations. And PETA says that through a phase-in, KFC Canada is going to purchase 100% of its chickens from suppliers that use the least cruel method of slaughter, which is controlled atmosphere killing. They're going to add a vegan chicken item to the menu of about 65% of KFCs in Canada. They're going to improve their welfare audit criteria to reduce the number of broken bones and other injuries suffered by birds, and they're going to be sending PETA audits, results of their audits every 6 months. They're going to urge their suppliers to adopt better farming practices, including improved lighting, lower stocking density and ammonia levels, and a phase out of growth-promoting drugs and breeding practices that cripple chickens. And they're going to form an animal welfare advisory panel, and PETA will have a say on who is on that advisory panel.
Well, that sounds like a vast improvements. Now, is there a timeline on any of this?
I believe that the CAK, the slaughter, is going to be phased in over a number of years. I'm not just clear on the timeline, but I believe it will be probably over 5 or 6 years, because the issue with controlled atmosphere killing is that there's only one slaughterhouse in Canada that actually does slaughter chickens with controlled atmosphere killing. So it's going to take them a while to change over, and PETA has given them some leeway in terms of changing over, because as you can imagine, it'll be very expensive. But I think the most important aspect of this entire victory for animals is that KFC in the U.S. and KFC worldwide are now going to have absolutely no excuse to refuse the animal welfare reforms that PETA's been demanding of them for the last 5 years. KFC Canada has taken a huge step forward and made it easier for other large companies, and particularly KFC in the United States, to come on board with these kinds of animal welfare reform.
5-year campaign. It took a long time, didn't it?
It did take a long time, and one thing you can say for PETA is they're persistent.
You bet. And I guess it was a financial issue somehow with the Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Well, I'll tell you, locally, there was definitely a financial issue. There's a great little group here in B.C. called Liberation B.C. Was started by Ashley Fruno, who is, did work for VHS for a while, and she's now working for PETA in Asia. And Joanne Chang, again, another VHS person, she was on our board for quite a while. She took over Liberation B.C. from Ashley when Ashley left. And between the two of them, they ran a 2-year campaign in Vancouver. Every single week, they were picketing one of the KFC restaurants. And in fact, there was one on Broadway that they picketed so consistently that the store eventually closed down.
Really?
Yes. So they had a huge effect just here in Vancouver. An absolutely humongous effort, and certainly these grassroots activists that supported PETA are really heroes. They just can't be applauded enough for what they did.
Yes, I know. Ashley and Joanne have both been on our show, and they have the courage of their convictions, and it's wonderful to see.
It is. It is wonderful.
Yeah.
It's very encouraging. Makes me tired, though.
Right. Yeah, it takes an awful lot of energy. You have to have youth on your side, I think, to do those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Now, any other points that we haven't covered?
I think. Well, again, just we did at one point VHS and a number of other organizations across Canada in April 2005 did sign a Competition Bureau complaint against KFC because KFC was saying that they had welfare at the heart of what they do, and they had actually been misleading consumers to think that their chickens were very well treated indeed. And with PETA and a number of other organizations, we did make a complaint to the Competition Bureau in Canada and managed to have those claims removed from their website and from their any of their publications. And I think that everybody in Canada really should give themselves a pat on the back, because all of these actions definitely had an effect in getting KFC Canada to go along with these reforms. And I do think that although people will think it's a horrendous place to go for a vegan chicken option, I really do think that as a vegetarian community, we do have to support KFC's vegan option so that it makes a go of it, because it's very important to have it there for people who would otherwise go there, maybe think, today I'm not going to have chicken, I'm going to try this other option, and we could get some new vegetarians.
Yes, it's wonderful that Canada is leading the way on this one, isn't it?
I'm very proud to be Canadian.
Good. Now, Carl has a question.
Now, at the Animal Welfare Conference at UBC, I was so proud of Vancouver Humane Society, because your speaker there, I think her name's Leanne, is it?
Leanne McConaughey, yes.
And she was the only one that spoke out against factory farming of animals, the only one.
She is quite an amazing person. She came out of the animal welfare program. In fact, as you'll have noted from being there, she is a graduate of the master's program there. So we're very proud of her. And there are some really great people coming out of that program, and I think that's a really good reason to support it.
Now, you've also been quite outspoken about the force feeding of ducks, and the product of that is, of course, fatty livers, which is considered to be a delicacy called foie gras. But I have a wonderful quote from the Globe and Mail yesterday, and it was written by Vancouver Humane Society representative Peter Fricker. And I put it in one of my favorite quotes, and I'll just read it here for our listeners. And Peter Fricker says, "Let's have morality take precedence over frivolous gluttony." Such a nice quote, Deborah.
That's wonderful. Yes, I actually hadn't read that letter, so I'm glad that you brought it to my attention. I'll give him a pat on the back.
So, of course, Joanne Chang's been very involved with the foie gras issue and standing outside restaurants and being vocal, and so has the Vancouver Humane Society. So maybe you can just tell us a bit about that campaign.
Well, that campaign really is a Liberation BC campaign. They've been extremely active on that front, and the news has come in, I believe, yesterday that Overweighty Foods have agreed to not sell foie gras at any of their stores, including Urban Fair. So we're very excited about that. And again, this is a Liberation BC victory. I'm just reading from their update. And Café de Paris also said that they would no longer be serving foie gras. And I think that Liberation BC has been very, very successful in Vancouver in making foie gras very similar to smoking. It's something that's socially unacceptable, and we're really, really pleased to have such a great grassroots group here in Vancouver.
Now, I'd like to just go back to the animal welfare program at UBC, which was so well organized by David
Fraser,
who was the MC. But apart from Leanne being the only one who spoke out against factory farming, all the others showed pictures of cows grazing on green fields. And I spoke to one of the persons who gave the presentation when they were talking about the issues of food production. And I said, you're always showing these animals on green fields. My statistics show that 75% of all dairy cows never leave the concrete, never go out on a grassy field. So she said to me, well, I think the figure is actually higher than that. So I said, well, why do you, on your screens here, you're always showing the cows on green fields? It's a total misrepresentation. And, of course, we also know that the average cow should be living about 20 to 25 years. That's the lifespan of an average cow. In Canada, the average dairy cow is what we call, you've been involved in this program too. The average lifespan is some 2.3 lactations, I think, some 3 or 4 years. So it's something that that I think the industry in many ways is we're being deceived, don't you think so?
I think that the general public isn't really aware of what's going on with dairy cattle. That's not to dismiss the important research that's going on at the UBC farm out in Agassiz on dairy cows, certainly having a tremendous effect on management techniques, and I think that it's important. But it is definitely a problem that people don't understand, that these dairy cows are probably one of the most abused, next to chickens in my opinion, the most abused animals in farming. They go to slaughter primarily because of lameness, and when this is happening, as you say, 5 to 6 years old, when a cow normally would live about 20 years, it's very disturbing, and certainly I think that consumers need to take that into consideration when they're purchasing these products. And I mean, our recommendation is if there's any way possible to reduce or stop consumption of these kinds of products, to stop this cruelty.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bruce Frederick from PETA, he said there's a chunk of veal in every glass of milk. I think people should maybe explore the reasons of why he said that.
Yes, and I another comment often made is that there's also pus in milk because of the bacterial infections that go on with dairy cows with mastitis. And mm-hmm. Yes, it's certainly not the most appetizing thought.
And mucus-forming stuff.
Yeah. Now, I think we have another question over here from Alan that we'd like to squeeze in, please.
I wanted to get back to the Kentucky Fried Chicken, the KFC, or as I have a newspaper article here where they refer to it as Kentucky Fried Cruelty. The subject we were talking about earlier, and it's Prism Income Fund that owns these Kentucky Fried stores in Canada, which is a huge company, and they also own Pizza Hut and Taco Bell. So we're talking about it. So actually, that makes the success even bigger that PETA and your organization and other organizations had. Because you're up against this huge multinational company that has, goodness knows, well, they have, I think, 461 KFC outlets in Canada, and goodness knows how many other outlets they have. And the question is this campaign continuing in other directions to try and get these other shops and other businesses controlled by Prism to follow suit? And then what you were just talking about in terms of dairy products and the way dairy cattle are treated obviously comes into this topic as well.
Yes, I think that that's a question for PETA. I'm afraid I can't answer that. But I do know that their focus is going to be on KFC in the United States and abroad now, because they have their foot in the door. They and the animals were very fortunate that KFC Canada is actually separate than KFC in the United States. So this is just such a huge move, and I believe that PETA will be focusing on getting KFCs internationally. I think that one of PETA's strategies and the main strategy that VHS takes on is a strategy of trying to affect the most suffering And that's what PETA's aim will be. They'll go after whatever is causing the most suffering to the most animals. I believe that that probably is going to mean a real focus now, really ramping up the KFC U.S. campaign.
Mm-hmm. Now we're going back to Carl again.
I hope
Deborah, you
know so much. Now, Tyson Foods, it's based in Arkansas, and that's where Bill Clinton hails from. And Tyson Foods is one of the largest producers of chickens in the United States, and they were one of the largest corporate contributors to the Bill Clinton election campaign. And when the companies are so enormous, and we see groups like the Vancouver Humane Society that work on limited budgets, and there's this gigantic disparity between what corporates can do and what people who basically volunteers can do. Don't you think you're doing just a great job?
Well, yes, I do. But you know, I think that one has to look at it this way. We have the truth on our side, and we are right. I think that that's what bolsters us when we look at these huge corporations. And to tell you the truth, I think that that's why there haven't been more lawsuits, because these companies, you would think, with all of their power, all of their money and their power, would be suing PETA into the ground. But they're not, because they know that we're telling the truth. We don't have to exaggerate the horrible things that are happening to animals. There's no exaggeration needed. What they're doing to animals is unconscionable, and they're doing it with the rubber stamp of the consumer. And I think that we really need to stress to people, and in our upcoming newsletter, I just wrote the editorial yesterday for it, consumers have so much power. That's what's making changes, not government legislation necessarily, although it's certainly a step in the right direction, but it's consumers who stopped going to KFC here in Canada, who wrote them letters, who said, we don't like what you're doing. We need to give consumers the tools to make the right decisions, and consumers never, ever should be belittling their own contribution to this.
It's well stated, Deborah.
Companies to do this.
The truth, yeah, it's so important. You know, people don't realize it. Now, Deborah, I want to say thank you so much for being with us today. You've been sort of questioned from all directions, but it's been a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Again, I'd like to say that it's just so wonderful to have such good news for a change.
Isn't it, though?
It is.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Deborah Probert, Executive Director of the Vancouver Humane Society. Now, Carl, some news items?
Oh, well, we always have news items. And this one is from Release Chimps. And it's a message that talking about supporting the Great Ape Protection Act in the United States. And she's based in Boston. And Dr. Jane Goodall and other scientists appealed to the European Union to end the use of animal testing in medical and other scientific research. And she went on to say, we need to recognize that what we do to animals is morally wrong and unacceptable. And she presented a petition bearing some 150,000 names to the European Parliament. Goodall and others called on the Parliament and executive officers to find methods of testing that do not involve animals. And she said that there are some 12 million animals that are used each year. I'm going to repeat this. 12 million animals are used each year in experiments across the European Union. And just one story about honoring the elders, and this time it is a chimpanzee. And last month in May, it was Wenka's 54th birthday. She's a chimpanzee, and she has spent more than 50 years in research, making her the oldest known chimpanzee in United States laboratories. And so they asked this organization called Release Chimps You can look up the webpage. She says, please join us in honoring her by taking action on behalf of her and all elder chimpanzees who remain in U.S. labs. It's time for a change.
Yes, and locally there's animals being used all the time, isn't there, in research?
Oh yes. I mean, in Canada, everywhere. I mean, it's enormous.
In Vancouver.
Yes. And, you know, it's so interesting to know that between different species of humans, you know, like from different origins, from Africans to Asians to Caucasians, we react differently to different drugs. And the medical profession is recognizing. Yet, they continue. How much more is the difference between humans and animals? And yet, we rely on these animal experimentations as being a valid method for justifying the proof of what would happen to animals. As somebody said, we're doing the experiments on the wrong species.
Right. Yeah, we've had guests on the program earlier last year and the year before talking about just that subject, making it perfectly clear. I mean, people who do research and who are experts in this field make it perfectly clear that it's ludicrous to be doing tests on mice and let alone chimpanzees or anything else and assume that your findings are going to be relevant to human beings. The fact is that what you're talking about different human your races, but between different human individuals there are differences. And the tendency in sophisticated medicine now is really to develop medications for the person who is ill, right? Rather than going entirely the opposite direction and doing experiments in animals and assuming that, you know, if a mouse responds to this particular medication, that a human being is going to as well. You know, it's a vast waste of money as well as the lives of these animals.
The absolute cruelty. Now, Alan, I have a question for you, and it's this. If you had an ailment, maybe a backache or something, or headache or something, would you go to a vet to have yourself diagnosed? So doesn't that put a perspective on animal experimentations that we're relying on animals for human conditions?
Your point is well taken, that it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And it's amazing that this industry is so well supported, but the trouble is it's a huge industry, this research industry, and there's all kinds of university departments and labs and, you know,
suppliers of all kinds.
Yeah, right. The whole industry from end to end, from the drug suppliers, from the pharmaceuticals companies,
from the cages,
who put all the money into this, you know, mm-hmm. and support the research done at the universities and so on, and then so they can justify what they're doing. But it's just never ceases to amaze me.
But isn't there legislation that kind of protects the drug supplier if he has done tests on animals? Because they're the legitimate proof at the present time, as I understand it, a legal proof that it's a safe drug because these tests have been carried out and the mice were not affected.
Well, it would be interesting to see somebody, in terms of legal proof, take it to court and get a legal opinion. If, you know, the sort of thing you get up to the Supreme Court, and it'd be interesting to see the arguments.
And maybe it's easier too to test on other species rather than testing on humans,
which
can be very touchy.
Yeah.
You know, Marge, when we're talking about all these items like this, I am really very thankful about the increasing ease with which it is to be a vegan. And in the past 20 years, we've just seen this gigantic change that there are vegetarian options in restaurants, there are vegan options in restaurants. And people are changing the way they, for many different reasons. Mm-hmm. And it's like Earth Save Canada, which is one of my absolute favorite organizations. And it's a wonderful non-profit educational organization that promotes the awareness of the health and the environmental and also the ethical consequences of our food choices. They advocate the move towards a plant-based diet for better health, environmental sustainability, and of course, compassion for animals. And that's what our program is all about. You know, in one of the editorials, they said in our human body we have some 100 trillion cells, each performing millions of tasks each second. For the body to be healthy and fit, these cells have to function as a resonant, harmonious whole. The magnificence of this complex orchestration is staggering, and it is synchronized by the body's intelligence, energy, and matter fields. And then they wrote, as far as the health benefits of plants and of plant foods, they said it knows no limits. The more scientists look, the more impressive data they develop concerning the array of health benefits conferred by fruits, nuts, seeds, beans, whole grains, and vegetables. It's pretty safe to say that science will never be able to delineate fully all the miraculous ways that the plants we ingest work to keep us alive and well.
Yes, and we should not be introducing genetically modified foods. I think that's a big mistake, and probably a little way down the road we'll discover what harm we have done with that kind of manipulation of our foods. Certainly, food treatments are far superior to drug treatments, as far as I'm concerned. And I think by proper diet and exercise and adequate sleep and so on, you're much better off than looking for a pill that's going to...
Well, you know, Marge, my fruit and vegetable of the month is red bell peppers. And I planted red bell peppers in my sunroom, and they have little blooms on them already.
Oh, wow.
They're doing very well in spite of the rain.
Uh-huh.
And you know that bell peppers are commonly thought of as vegetables, mm-hmm. but they're actually classified as fruits.
Imagine that.
Mm-hmm. Their vibrant mm-hmm. colors yeah. are an indication of their health-promoting qualities. So mix a few red peppers, yellow peppers into your salad
today.
Today, tomorrow, and the day thereafter.
Okay, we're going to have to cut it there because we're out of time. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices on CFRO 102.7 FM. And please tune in again next week, Friday noon, and hear some more on these topics. Thank you.